Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. On this show, we speak to Justin Pedor, writer and editor for Z Magazine. We take a look at the role of industrial capitalism and neoliberalism, which has been creating and expanding poverty in the world, with a special focus on India. So stay tuned.
Someone who has been actively working on creating social transformation is Justin Pedor. He is a writer and editor for Zed Magazine. You can reach his articles at zedmagazine.org. He's also part of Zed Communications, an alternative media organization dedicated to political analysis and support for movements for social change. He has reported from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Pakistan, India, Haiti, Venezuela, Colombia, Argentina, Brazil, Israel, Palestine, and Mexico, and writes on North America as well. He has written for Zed Magazine, Frontline, India, New Politics, New Left Review, Rabble.ca, and other publications, and is part of the Pueblos en Camino collective. We're very privileged to have on our show this morning Justin Pedor. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Today we are focusing on the issue of sustainability and the role that industrial capitalism and neoliberalism has had creating poverty in the world, but focusing particularly in Asia. Paint a picture for us. You have traveled and reported from India. What is this, the landscape in the cultural? How is it organized and how does it contrast the new politics of neoliberalism?
I think one of the best rural reporters in the world, and also certainly in India, a guy named P. Sainath, who writes for The Hindu, said a phrase that I really like a lot. He said, India's greatest industry today is not IT, and it's not software, it's actually inequality. And that, I think, is the most stark characteristic of India today. India has always been a very unequal society. When I was there, a lot of the activists that I got to spend some time with, a person I call my adopted uncle, Badri Raina, who also writes for Z, Badri said, you know, India is a society where the problems, the inequalities, the hierarchies, they don't just trace back a couple of hundred years to colonialism. They trace back thousands of years to caste and patriarchy. So the history of India is one where there was a traditional society which was very unequal, thanks largely to the caste system, where there was deep, profound patriarchy and regional differences and political and economic inequality. And then colonialism overlaid on that and exacerbated that. And today, neoliberalism has made it deeper and much more intense. So you have a situation in India today where India has the fourth largest number of billionaires in the world. These are all things that I got from Sainath, but he uses Forbes and in Times of India to point out. After the U.S., Russia, and Germany, India has the most billionaires in the world, and it's also 137th in terms of the Human Development Index, according to the United Nations. So that is a picture of inequality. You have 800 million or so people living on less than 50 cents a day, and you have somebody like Ambani, who's one of these billionaires, building a $2 billion home in Bombay or in Mumbai at the same time as this 800 million people are on 50 cents a day, 250 million people are on 24 cents a day. That is, I think, the defining characteristic of India. I mean, there is democracy, there is, you know, remarkable growth rates. Right now, there's a massive rearming and a kind of a orientation toward militarism and defense spending. There's the conflict with Pakistan. There's all these things are going on in India, but I think the central story and the central, the most important thing that's going on is that this inequality.
In Latin America, inequality has also exacerbated and primarily has been connected to the displacement of people from the land, people being removed. What is the connection to land and poverty in India?
Well, those processes that you describe in Latin America are certainly present in India, and they've actually become much worse in the past 10 or 15 years. Most Indians still make their living from agriculture. They're still out there trying to live on the land and make their living on the land. And lots of those Indians are landless. They're landless rural workers. And that whole agricultural economy depends tremendously on support from the government. Support in terms of price, support in terms of subsidies, support in terms of agricultural programs, fertilizer, pesticides, water, electricity, all of the things that go into a farm economy that are not solely land. All of those inputs are necessary. I mean, India is a very densely populated country. There's a lot of people. India has tremendous resources to support those people, but there is pressure on the land in a way that there isn't in a lot of Latin America. A lot of Latin America, there's lots of land that's controlled by very few people. In India, there's lots of people. There's lots of land, but really any displacement of any scale has massive human impacts in India and displaces tens or hundreds of thousands or millions of people. 8 million people have left agriculture in India in the past decade or so. And as Sainath pointed out in his talk, we don't actually know where those people all went. In the past 10 years or 15 years, you've seen the growth of, and this will be very familiar to students of Latin America and to Latin Americans, special economic zones. So these are zones where there are tax exemptions, where the regular rules of economic life and of business don't apply. Unions are not allowed to organize in the same way. So it's like rules-free zones for export-based processing. And the special economic zones, there's a number of them in India now, and the biggest controversy has to do with acquisition of land for these zones in the first place. And the government takes the land, displaces people, and turns them over to these special economic zones, and the benefits of these zones are not commensurate to the tremendous costs, economic costs and development costs, let alone human costs and displacement and so on. And another thing that happened and that has been happening over the past 10, 20 years, actually since independence in India, is mega projects, which is another thing that's very familiar to Latin Americans. Arundhati Roy wrote about this a lot. Then there was a movement called the Narmada Bachao Andolan. Medha Patkar was important in organizing with this movement. They were trying to bring attention. They were trying to hold onto the lands that they were farming and they were living on against a mega project that basically flooded them and flooded these tens of thousands of people in this dam. And Arundhati pointed out, and Medha Patkar pointed out, and the NBA pointed out, the Narmada Bachao Andolan pointed out, that the benefits of these dams were also presented in a way that really didn't balance them against the massive displacements that were going on and the hit to the agricultural economy and, most importantly, to the villages, to the agricultural workers and the people there, the people that were living there.
In Latin America, the indigenous populations are displaced, normally because they have a different relationship to the land than those who have this notion of private ownership, right? Indigenous people tend to see the land as them belonging to the land rather than the land belonging to them. And so this difference in paradigm creates a place where they can be excluded because they don't hold titles. They don't have a paper that says, this is my land from here to here, but rather they've been there. And so they share the land, they take care of the land. And in India, it's Sainath speaks about how many of the tribal, you know, they're called in the name of development, right? Development of tribals, which is this idea that somehow they're not developed. Can you speak about this, the connection between international aid and government aid in the exacerbation of displacement of tribal regions?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually in the constitution of India that they're referred to as backward. And I mean, it's actually, that word doesn't have the same exact connotation that it does say, in North America, where settler society would call indigenous people backward. In fact, in India, it's a little different from that, but some of the logic is similar. So it's actually a very insincere promise of development, right? I mean, look, this is a complicated issue. You know, Arundhati Roy, when she started her anti-dam essay, she said, look, I'm not an anti-development junkie. I'm not somebody who romanticizes village life with all the caste and other kinds of baggage. Like, it's not a utopia. And lots of people, including indigenous people, want some of these, you know, things, like to have modern communication and to have various other kinds of amenities. The thing is, it's all very insincere when the state, the settler state, or in India, just a neoliberal state, I suppose, makes these promises, because they're saying, yeah, we're going to help you develop, but in fact, what they're really going to help you do is they're going to take your land, they're going to use it for some project, they're going to displace you to the city where you become an itinerant laborer with no control over the land or any other thing, including your own development process. I mean, development is only meaningful in a context of sovereignty, or in the case of indigenous communities, of self-determination. And unless people are in control of their own development process, then the idea of a state coming in and developing you is fundamentally flawed. It's fundamentally anti-development. And it opens itself up to lots of abuse, which is what ends up happening in every case when it's actually applied, when people don't control their development process. So in India, the funds that go and the projects that exist for development of the backward castes or the tribal peoples or the Adivasis, as they're called, look at the actual implementation and you'll see displacement, you know, destruction of the traditional economy and the traditional resources, and really no benefits going anywhere except to the same corporations and the same elites that they go to. That's the broad picture. You could look at a case like the Narmada or any of the dams or some of the special economic zones in the south, like in Andhra Pradesh or other places. So the same logic that you're describing for Latin America certainly does apply, and frankly, Canada as well, right? A lot of the destruction of indigenous communities in Canada and their economic base has been done in the name of helping them to develop, which is just an argument that I think we shouldn't accept at all.
One of the things that goes often ignored is the role that international institutions play, like the WTO, the IMF, in particularly, in creating the structural basis from which this inequality continues to grow. Can you speak to this?
So the international financial institutions, and to a lesser extent, all of the other international aid institutions, are based implicitly on an economic model that says, borrow this money, invest in export-oriented industries, export, earn foreign exchange, and repay the loan. The trouble is that in a country like India, for example, where it's a lot, tremendous agricultural resources, for example. I mean, tremendous every kind of resources. But if they're focusing on agriculture, then they end up focusing on cash crops, whatever it is, indigo, cotton, whatever. It's not subsistence agriculture. It's not people growing things that they can eat. It's growing things for the international market. And what ends up happening is people become very food insecure. They end up exporting commodities that these same international financial institutions are telling all these other countries to do, so that you end up getting a glut on the international market. The prices go down. They're not able to earn the foreign exchange. They're not able to repay the loans. The loans increase. And in the end, the amount that the country owes keeps growing, the interest on it grows, the annual payments grow, the budget is totally thrown off, countries are not able to earn enough in taxation to pay that, and the control of their entire economy and their economic policy leaves their own hands and goes into the hands of the creditors, which are creditors, often commercial banks, in fact, of the West, that are organized through these international financial institutions. So the effect of it all is for foreign interests to take control of third world or poor countries' economies. That's the process in Latin America. In India, it's actually a little more complicated than that. Because India is so big, and because the Indian state and the Indian government and Indian capital actually does play a very strong role. Remember, this is a country that has a tremendous amount of billionaires. It's a country that has tremendous wealth. It's a country that's undergone growth rates of 9% for the past decade. So you're talking about a lot of these international processes that play out are also playing out within India, between the Indian elite and the Indian masses, the Indian poor, the Indian majority. And Arundhati Roy, again, you know, Indian analysts and writers are actually so, you know, if you want to learn about India, read Sainath and Vandana and Arundhati, and you're doing pretty well. But Arundhati said something like, we're in the midst of the most successful secession movement, you know, like separatism in India right now. There's a thing where India is multi-ethnic and regional and multilingual, so there's often separatist sentiments, right, in India. But Arundhati said the real separatist movement in India is the Indian elite, which is separating itself from the Indian population. And that's like the most successful and the most dramatic secession that's happened in history, perhaps in Indian history at least. That's the process that's going on. So the international financial institutions are playing a huge role, but in India, the Indian elite is also playing a huge role.
And that's such an important point to make. As you said, in a country where they have the fourth largest number of millionaires, you also have a place where diarrhea claims close to 1.5 million infants each year. You know, like every 3 minutes, a child is dying of something that's so preventable. So why are these connections so alien to us as a society? What can we do to create transformative change? You know, in what ways do we as an international community participate in the exacerbation and the entrenchments of these policies that create so much inequality in the third world?
It's really a model. I mean, I like to quote John Maynard Keynes. He has this quote that I love to use, which is, and I'm going to mess it up a little bit, but he basically says, practical people who have no use for theory are actually unconsciously quoting or living out the scribblings of some obscure academic scribbler who wrote 50 years ago. But his point is, you might think that you're practical and have nothing to do with theory. In fact, you're living by somebody else's theory if you don't understand yourself. And all of this stuff is coming from a really fundamentally anti-human economic model, which does serve the interests of tiny, tiny group of people, is ultimately from the point of view of sustainability, which I understand you were talking about on the show, and from the point of view of the Earth and the ecosystems that sustain life on this planet, is suicidal. So it's totally suicidal from the point of view of humanity. It's totally suicidal from the point of view of society, and it's rational from the point of view of some short-term profit-seeking logic. And that's the model. And that's the model that we all live by. Now, it's one thing for corporations and for CEOs and people who are absurdly wealthy in this system to support it and to support this model. It's enriching them. It makes sense for them to support it. But for the rest of us, to support it is actually totally irrational. And for us to accept it as the only way to organize economic life, for us to accept it as inevitable, is bringing us closer to ecocide and suicide. So I think the starting point has to be rejection of this model. You might think of fighting it your way, you might fight it my way. All of these struggles that go on against this model have a unique or local kind of character to them. The model tries to impose itself everywhere, but peoples and communities and ecosystems and regions, they all are different, and struggles are going to be different in different contexts. The important thing is to not let it happen in silence, and the important thing is to reject the model and to not accept that it's the only way that things can be, and convince everyone that you know that it's not the only way that things can be. And start those conversations. Maybe if enough people think that, we can actually talk about what we can do. It's also to try to create a dialogue. One thing that I've been doing for a while now is I've been doing like some media trainings. I've been talking to people who are starting to write and who are interested in trying to do media-related work. And one thing that I tell them is we're not limited now. The way that the kind of media landscape works right now, we're not really limited by outlets. You can always get your words out there. Whether you can get people's interest is another matter, and there's lots of ways to try to do that. But I think the biggest thing that we lack as the team that's seeking social change is lots and lots of people getting out there and saying things. I think that there's so much room, so much space, so much empty space for those voices right now that we really need more and more people to fill them. You know, one of the things that I said a while ago in a talk, you know, really, when you're starting out and when you're doing these things, really don't think of market niches. Don't think of how you're going to position yourself, and don't think of other people who are writing as your competitors or your rivals. Like, think of them as on the same team, and think of them as people who are going to help you and as people who you can and should be helping. Really, there's a group of people who are talking, there's a bigger group of people who are listening and who agree, and those people should all be talking too. And if all those people were talking, maybe we could grow more. And there are a range of reasons why people don't pick up the keyboard or get on the radio or pick up the microphone should be overcome. And I guess that's what I would say as a starting point to people is, you know, find your voice and say what you have to say, because we don't want to let this pass in silence.
And the silence component, I think, is a very important part. In your recent blog, you talk about an event that took place when Nero invited a guest to a party. And I wonder if you could just share that story for our audience and the importance of our voices.
Talking about the fire in Rome, and there was a big fire, which they wondered whether Nero, the emperor Nero, set, or whether he was, you've heard that he was playing the fiddle or whatever while Rome burned. You've probably heard that quote. But so there was a big fire, and in order to distract the people from the fire, he held a party. And at the party, they had a bunch of criminals who they lit on fire. So the people were burning at night while the party was going on. And, you know, the cruelty of it didn't strike me as much as I wondered who Nero's guests were and why they didn't say anything. And that's what I think of when I think of us today, is I don't want to be one of Nero's guests, and I want to say something.
Thank you so much for being with us. That's beautiful. My guest is Justin Pudor. He is a writer for Zed Magazine. He also has a blog, killandtrain.com, and he is also a contributor to Pueblos en Camino Collective. You can reach Pueblos en Camino by going to www.nen/camino.org or go to killandtrain.com. Thank you again for joining us.
Bye, Celia.
Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Pra que tanta dor? Pra que tanto ódio? Se somos irmãos e temos, e temos, e temos que dar as mãos. Pra que tanta dor? Pra que tanto ódio? Se somos irmãos e temos, e temos, e temos que dar as mãos. Oh, 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 vem cá de dentro, a nossa terra está a morrer. Olha o tormento, olha o tormento que vem cá de dentro, a nossa terra está a sofrer demais. não tem lamento. A nossa terra está a morrer. Angola é tão grande, tão rica e tão linda, que dá pra todos nós e pra quem ama Angola. Oh, 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 oh. Angola é tão bela, tão rica e tão linda, que dá pra todos nós e pra quem ama Angola. Angola é tão bela, Angola é tão linda, tão rica e tão grande, que dá pra todos nós e pra quem ama Angola.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the US. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.